broadcasting from the Bitcoin bunker six blocks below, brandishing the blockchain to fight good versus evil. This is Bitcoin versus the man. This is the battle of the century. This is the Mad Money Machine. Hey everybody, Paul Boyer here. Welcome to episode 5 of the Mad Money Machine for Thursday, January 30th, 2014. Coming up on this episode, we will have a role-playing game, and we'll find out whether the company that promises not to do evil will get into Bitcoin. Of course, we'll talk about Charlie Shrim, and we'll talk about the BitLicense hearings in New York City. We'll talk about the hottest altcoin in the world, and we will talk about the improvements we can expect to the existing Bitcoin protocol, along with a tool of the week and a spin at the guru wheel. In the news, Sir Richard Branson says he's already got 6 or 7 people who paid in Bitcoin to fly his Virgin Galactic to space. And I'm thinking, if we pool our Bitcoin, we could send 6 or 7 politicians to space, and if we make it a one-way trip, we could get it for half price. Pope Francis calls the internet a gift from God, saying it is something truly good and offers immense possibilities for encounter and solidarity. In other news, the NSA calls the internet a gift from God, saying it is something truly good and offers immense possibilities for encounter and surveillance. Let's start out today's show with a little role-playing game. Let's pretend that you are the head of some really big multinational bank. A bank that does commodities, consumer banking, corporate banking, credit cards, finance and insurance, foreign currency exchange, global banking, mortgage loans, risk management, treasury services, underwriting, and all kinds of stuff. And you've got almost 260,000 people working for you. You do about $100 billion in revenue per year. Now, someone with a camera and a microphone comes up to you and asks you, "What do you think about Bitcoin?" Let's see if you would pass the test.
The question isn't whether we accept it. The question is, do we even participate in people who facilitate Bitcoin? So
we don't even want to be associated with people who do anything with Bitcoin. Nice.
It's a terrible store of value.
Up from $10 to $1,000 in the past year. Yes, that's terrible.
It could be replicated over and over.
That's right, like Dogecoin.
It doesn't have the standing of a government.
Now, hold on. Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
And honestly, a lot of it, what I've read from you guys, a lot of it's being used for illicit purposes.
You've got a nice list of prepared points about Bitcoin there, don't you? You're good.
And the people who are going to eventually really get upset with it will be governments.
Ooh, and we don't want government upset.
You know, so governments put a huge amount of pressure on banks and so to know who your client is, anti-money laundering, right. Is it being used for legal purposes, did you do, you know, real reviews of that? Well, obviously, it's almost impossible to do with something like that.
Now, wait a minute. Did the government put the pressure on the banks to do that? Or did the banks put the pressure on the government to put the pressure on the banks to do that?
So they will eventually be made, as a payment system, might be, to follow the same standards as all these other payment systems. That will probably be the end of them.
Yeah. That'll probably be the end of it, at least as far as you can control, right? Well, you're good. You're a good CEO. And you know what good CEOs of major banks do? They get promoted to Treasury Secretary of the United States. What do you say then when you're asked about Bitcoin? Let me offer you a suggestion. Talk about how it could be used for illegal activity. Talk about how it's anonymous. And talk about how it might fund terrorism.
What does the government think of Bitcoin?
Well, look, I think that Bitcoin is a phenomenon that we need more time to discuss. I've talked to Jamie Dimon about it. I think he and I both share a certain incredulity about the whole phenomenon. I think from the government's perspective, we have to make sure it does not become an avenue to funding illegal activities.
Yes.
Or to funding activities that have malign purposes like terrorist activities.
Yes, terrorism.
It is an anonymous form of transaction. and it offers places for people to hide. We've made it clear through enforcement actions that we will look at these forms of transaction and we will enforce all of the rules we have on illegal money activity.
Yes, we will. We will try to shut anybody down that has their fingers in the Bitcoin pie. Just like Charlie Shrem, CEO of Bitcoin exchange BitInstant and vice chairman of the Bitcoin Foundation. And just a little bit of background, BitInstant actually stopped doing business this past July. They'd had some customer problems, as I understand it. Now, Charlie Shrem was scheduled to speak this past weekend, January 26th, at the Miami Bitcoin Conference. People there were probably wondering why he didn't show up. Turns out, we find out, Monday, January 27th, he was arrested at the JFK Airport for money laundering. The attorney for the Southern District of New York and the New York Field Division of the DEA and an agent from the IRS announced they unsealed criminal charges in Manhattan federal court against Robert Fiella, also known as BTC King, and Charlie Shrem for engaging in a scheme to sell over $1 million in bitcoins to users of Silk Road. The IRS special agent in charge said the government has been successful in swiftly identifying those responsible for the design and operation of the Silk Road website, as well as those who helped Silk Road customers conduct their illegal transactions by facilitating the conversion of dollars into bitcoins. This is yet another example of the New York Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Strike Force's proficiency in applying financial investigative resources to the fight against illegal drugs. Well, let's hear a little bit from Charlie Shrem's talk at the Bitcoin conference last May in San Jose. He was talking about how you do have to play nice with the regulators.
You have to know your customer. I'm going to say it again. You have to know your customer. Any startup, any Bitcoin company, anyone doing anything in the Bitcoin space, you have to know your customer. It's a very, very big problem when you have someone trying to start a Bitcoin company and saying, you know what, I'm just going to not care. I'm just going to let anyone use my system and have a nice day. You can't do that. Because if you're going to be operating a company in the United States, and if you're going to have employees, if you're going to be paying them health benefits, if you're going to be paying them salaries, if you're going to be running and operating a real company, you have to be compliant in that country. Whether or not you agree with the laws or not, you got to follow them or you got to leave.
Which is what Eric Voorhees did. He left and took his business to Panama.
All I know is that America is a place of innovation, and the more regulation we put on it, the more regulation we put on it, the worse it's going to get, and we're just going to push people out. So I think Bitcoin working together with different companies, with banks, with payment systems, can do really, really great, amazing things. I think that Bitcoin in places like Africa and the Middle East can really harness amazing, amazing technology.
America is the greatest place of innovation. Let's not stifle that innovation with over-regulation. He continues now talking about money laundering.
So there are a lot of challenges when it comes to regulatory stuff with KYC. You have to know your customer. But at the same time, the whole term of anti-money laundering was a bank invented term. And really, I like to use KYC, know your customer, a lot better, because it doesn't sound like it's like a criminal. When you open up a bank account or do anything financial related, I personally feel like, and a lot of people I speak to feel like, you're treated like a criminal on the outset. And you're having to like prove yourself. And in America, it's supposed to be, I think it's supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. But when you get audited with things like the IRS, it's more like guilty until proven innocent. And that's how the whole financial regulation took hold over that.
He went on to explain the steps he took at BitInstant to comply with the regulations.
So BitInstant right now, we do basic OFAC, of course. We have to check your names against the Office of Foreign Assets Control. And we've built a three-tiered KYC system, which says that, look, if you don't want to trust us with your social security number, that's fine. We can't put you on such high limits yet. If you don't want to give us your ID, that's okay too. We can't put you on high limits yet. But we still need to ask you basic information. We'll start you off with a $500 a day limit, start you off with a $1,000 a day limit. It's more of like, you trust us, we trust you. Type of situation. And that was kind of frowned on. A lot of regulators frowned on that with me. But I said, it's going to work, and it has been working so far.
Well, apparently not. Now, if Bitcoin is so anonymous and so dangerous, how in the world did they catch these guys? They must be geniuses. Poor old Charlie. I guess he didn't have friends in all the right places. I guess he didn't pay his tribute to the capital. And what kind of friends do you need? You need a friend as a CEO at a major bank. You need a friend in the Treasury. You need a friend in the Attorney's Office of the new state of New York. You need a friend in the IRS. And you need a friend in the DEA. Now let's hear from another guy who doesn't have any friends. Edward Snowden was interviewed in Germany recently.
Government policies are being influenced by private corporations who have interests that are completely divorced from the public good in mind.
Now, he was not talking about banking and banking regulators, but it seems to be applicable here. And he also went on to talk about what a solution could be in his case, and it could be a solution in this case as well.
Ultimately, the solution to that is not to try to stick everything in a walled garden, although that does raise the level of sophistication and complexity of taking the information. It's also much better simply to secure the information internationally against everyone rather than playing let's move the data. Moving the data isn't fixing the problem. Securing the data is the problem.
Securing the data is the problem, yes, but securing the data is also the solution. The Mad Money Machine will continue to follow this and other stories and bring you the updates. Now let's lighten things up a little bit by pulling something out of the Mad Money Machine Bitcoin Tool Crib. You know, at the end of the last show, I kind of jokingly read my Bitcoin donation address as a base 58 string, which is very difficult to read because you've got to discriminate between uppercase and lowercase characters. So that brings us to this week's tool. Brainwallet.org has a neat little converter. If you absolutely have to read someone your Bitcoin address over audio, you can put it into brainwallet.org converter and then click the poetry button, and it will translate the characters in the Bitcoin address into 15 words of poetry. So let me read you mine. Meet happiness, eager, like Hillbeam. Abuse confidence, goodbye. Awake, scary dude, diamond flicker law. That was a whole lot easier, wasn't it? And it's so lovely sounding. Yeah, you go out to brainwallet.org. You just copy and paste the address in the top box. And then below, you click on the poetry tab. And it will give you those words of poetry. Now, what does someone do when they receive those words? Well, they go out to brainwallet.org. They enter those words into the top box, clicking the poetry button. And then down below, they click the base 58 check tab. And that gives them the Bitcoin address to which they can send you Bitcoin. Well, there's a lot of other neat things, obviously, that happen out at brainwallet.org, but I think that's just a really little cool little thing. I don't know if anyone's ever going to use it. But hey, Bitcoin poetry is cool. And like the best things in life, at brainwallet.org, the poetry converter is free. The best things in life are free. You can keep it for the birds and bees knocking me on it. That's what I want. You probably remember how I talked about I'm never going back to the DC Bitcoin meetup. It's just too daggone far, too inconvenient for me to get to. Well, guess what? This past Monday, I went to the DC Bitcoin meetup because it wasn't held in DC. It was held in Arlington, a whole lot easier to get to. I mean, still 45 minutes away for me. But also went to, on Tuesday then, our Northern Virginia Bitcoin meetup held in Reston. Both meetups were great. The one in Arlington was attended by 25 to 30 guys. The one in Reston, there was about 7 or 8 of us. But, you know, it's great to talk to guys that know a lot about Bitcoin. And we're going to keep doing it.
The BitGive Foundation is a nonprofit charitable giving organization leveraging the power of the Bitcoin community to improve public health and the environment worldwide. Help us demonstrate the significant impact of Bitcoin in addressing these critical issues on a global scale. Support international giving in Bitcoin please visit our website at www.biggivefoundation.org. That's www.biggivefoundation.org.
Hi, listener. Here at Let's Talk Bitcoin, we're building a global network of correspondents able to contribute on-the-ground perspective when cryptocurrency-related information comes across their filters. If you'd like to join our global conversation, send an email with your name and geographic or cultural niche to apply@letstalkbitcoin.com. Just like Bitcoin, the only barrier to entry is your time and good work. Thanks for listening.
Article in the Wall Street Journal a few days ago. Apple pushes deeper into mobile payments. Tech giant lays groundwork to expand service for physical goods. Apple is laying the groundwork for an expanded mobile payment service, leveraging its growing base of iPhone and iPad users and the hundreds of millions of credit cards on file through its iTunes store. Do you think Apple will offer to allow people to pay using Bitcoin? You know, everybody wants to kick bad habits and get into some good habits. Here's a good habit you need to get into. Before you buy anything anywhere, go to gift.com, G-Y-F-T. Why? Because you can save some money. And you can use Bitcoin if you want to make your purchase of gift cards. Say, for example, that you're going to go out and buy some golf clubs and you're going to go to Golfsmith to do it. First, check gift.com. Yes, they've got a Golfsmith gift card that you can purchase. Now, you can spend your Bitcoin there and you'll get 3% discount back when you buy your next gift card. Or say you're going out to eat. Even Burger King. They've got gift cards for Burger King, Bubba Gump Shrimp, and Red Robin. Yeah, before you go out to eat, it's very simple. Go to gift.com, G-Y-F-T. Select the gift card you want to purchase. Use your Bitcoin to buy it. Very simple. If you're at work and you don't have your Bitcoin wallet with you, you can use credit card or PayPal. And to make it easy to spend your gift card at one of these stores, download the gift.com app for your smartphone. It organizes and keeps track of the gift cards that you have. You show the merchant the screen on your smartphone. They zap it with their red laser, and you're on your way. I just bought some shoes last week from Zappos. Went to gift.com first, got a gift card, entered the code that I got back on the Zappos website, and like magic, it was instantly applied to the purchase. Get into the good habit of going to gift.com, G-Y-F-T. Why? It'll save you some money. What do you think about the timing of the arrest of Charlie Shrem? Wasn't that quite a coincidence? He was getting on a plane to go speak at the Bitcoin conference in Miami, and 2 days before the hearings in front of the New York Department of Financial Services. Man, what a coincidence. And here's another coincidence. I just happen to have some clips from that New York Department of Financial Services hearing. Here's Benjamin Lawski.
If the choice ultimately is between preventing money laundering on the one hand, then I probably even shouldn't use the word money laundering because it's too nice a word, frankly.
Wait. What did Charlie Shrem say about the term money laundering?
The whole term of anti-money laundering was a bank-invented term. And really, I like to use KYC, know your customer, a lot better, because it doesn't sound like it's like a criminal.
Well, all right. Money laundering is too nice a term. So tell us, Mr. Lawski, what is money laundering?
Money laundering is the facilitation of all kinds of horrific crimes that I think everyone in this room never wants to see happen. Narco-trafficking being one, but acts of terrorism, funding rogue nations, etc., all take place through massive money laundering. Now, we have it in our system as we do now. But if to have money laundering, if the choice for the regulator is permit money laundering on the one hand or permit innovation on the other, we're always going to choose squelching the money laundering first.
Yeah, because if we allow money laundering, then we'll be out of a job. So what we want to do is have more regulations so we can hire more people so we can be the boss over them.
It's simply, it's not worth it to society to allow money laundering and all of the things it facilitates to persist in order to permit a thousand flowers to bloom on the innovation side.
We'll be willing to let one flower bloom as long as it's a thorny rose.
I think the question is whether we can get somewhere in between where we're very comfortable that we're preventing the money laundering, but still allowing innovation.
Very comfortable. Yeah, we'll allow innovation. Well, this Losky guy goes on to talk about, hey, we've got regulators in banks. Maybe they could apply to Bitcoin, at which Fred Wilson chimes in a little bit later. You'll think it's fun.
Certainly, there is an entire industry right now helping banks try to stay compliant, for better and worse sometimes, with our BSA AML XYZ PDQ rules. And certainly, there's an industry already out there that could, you know, maybe part of or a piece of it could be spun off more into the virtual world to try and help fledgling companies do that. But it would be a way to ensure that, yes, it's a small company, yes, we want them to innovate, but at the same time, we just can't live in a world where we're going to permit money laundering to go on.
Well, that sounds like a terrible idea to me. You're talking about introducing of the costs back into the system that we're trying to take out of the system. Okay, let's just understand what we're trying to do with Bitcoin. We're trying to create a world where transactions can move globally for free, okay? And making these companies hire, you know, some outsourced compliance firm is a bad idea. The good idea is to put the compliance into the code, okay?
So that's Fred Wilson. Now, he was born August 20th, 1961, 16 days after Barack Obama. All right. He's a New York City-based venture capitalist and blogger. He's the co-founder of Union Square Ventures, a venture capital firm with investments in Web 2.0 companies such as Twitter, Tumblr, Foursquare, Zynga, and Kickstarter. And he also loves Bitcoin.
But the flip side is, as regulators, we're trying to make sure not when Fred Wilson opens account, but...
Nah, we don't care about Fred Wilson. But surely you don't mean to suggest that by allowing Bitcoin to flourish that it could cause the next 9/11?
Someone else, you know, we're 50 yards from the old World Trade Center here, and I think all of us never want to see anything like that happen again. And I don't... It would have been a lot harder for 9/11 to ever have occurred had we had the protections in place that would prevent the movement of massive amounts of money around the globe by people who would want to kill everybody in this room.
Wow, I think Osama bin Laden used Bitcoin to perpetrate his crimes. I never knew.
I think the key is to not create useless regulation, but I think the motives behind a lot of those rules are to ensure we don't miss something again.
Because you never know, Charlie Shrim could turn out to be the next Osama bin Laden. Let's skip ahead in the testimony and hear more from Fred Wilson as he talks about what the response might be from big companies that have something to lose against Bitcoin.
One thing we'll see this year, which I think will ultimately be a failure, is that we will see the banking industry and other interested parties come up with their own implementations of a virtual currency model that is more secure, more safe, more trusted, whatever that might be. But that'll play out a lot like CompuServe and AOL and Prodigy, which is ultimately these sort of, you know, fake internets didn't survive, and I don't think the fake Bitcoins will either.
I guess if I can follow up on that, so why would those systems be considered sort of fake internets, and say some of these traditional payment systems lower their costs? How do you guys stay competitive?
Well, what I was talking about was what I think we will see as a competitive response is a lot of the industries that have something to lose in a Bitcoin world will come up with things that, you know, are kind of, you know, halfway. You know, oh, well, you know, we built this system that we own, by the way. Nobody owns Bitcoin, right? So anytime you see a system that's owned and operated by somebody, like, that should be a red flag, because that's not going to work. What works is a system that's open source, that's peer-to-peer, that's not owned and controlled by anybody. That's the only thing that an entrepreneur can have confidence to build on top of. So nobody's going to build on top of JP Morgan Chase's, you know, Bitcoin. Like, that's not going to happen.
Right, and I wonder if the regulators would somehow approve the JP Morgan Chase Bitcoin and not approve some of the other Bitcoins. Well, Fred Wilson was just one of the several witnesses that appeared before that hearing over the course of 2 days. And if there's anything else interesting, I'll report it to you on the next show. I'll continue monitoring the fight of good versus evil. And speaking of evil, here's a report of a company whose motto is, "Don't be evil." One of the guys I met at the DC Bitcoin meetup was Gerard. He's the guy that sent the email to Google. He talked briefly about his interaction with Google. He got some pretty serious Reddit juice when he posted his interaction with Google. He says, "On a whim, I sent an email to Vic Gundotra, Senior Vice President of Social for Google, an email about Bitcoin and why it's the most disruptive technology since the internet itself, and how I'm not the only one out there wondering when or if they have plans to incorporate it into Google Wallet. He immediately responded and said they are paying attention, and he actually CC'd the gentleman who runs Google Wallet, Sridhar Ramaswamy, Senior Vice President, Ads and Commerce at Google." And Gerard entered into a dialogue with him, and here is his takeaway from that. He says, A, one of the bosses actually responded to an email from an absolute nobody about Bitcoin. B, Google is paying attention to Bitcoin. He would never have responded or said those words if Google is positioning themselves to be anti-Bitcoin, or even if to try to create a product to rival Bitcoin. And C, he put me in touch with the man who runs the Google Wallet division. The bottom line is he got the email back from Google saying, "Hi, Gerard, thanks for writing us. Really appreciate the feedback. We are working in the payments team to figure out how to incorporate Bitcoin into our plans. We will be in touch when we are a little bit more sure." Now, all this reminded me of a talk I heard on episode 32 of Let's Talk Bitcoin from Manu Sporny of the World Wide Web Consortium. Let's listen to a little bit of that.
The questions that we want to ask, how are we going to get 2 billion people onto Bitcoin, need to be a little more pointed, right? How do we do this in the next 5 years? Because by putting a time limit on it, we time box it, and by time boxing it, we start reaching for low-hanging fruit, right? We start being a little more creative with the solutions for getting Bitcoin adopted in a much larger way. The other, you know, question to ask is, what ecosystem currently has 2 billion people that are fairly accessible to the Bitcoin community? So is it the cell phone providers around the world? There are many billions of people that have cell phones around the world. Is it the banks? Is it something completely new, a new protocol for the internet? And I think, really, the answer is pretty obvious. There's only one network on the planet that is 2 billion strong. There's only one network in the world that has a fairly even playing field, and that's the web. 2.4 billion people access the web on a regular basis now. And if we're talking about asking the right questions, how do you get Bitcoin technology in front of 2.4 billion people? Well, it turns out that 97% of those people use one of four web browsers. One of four companies, so basically those browsers are Internet Explorer, Safari, Apple Safari, Google Chrome, Mozilla Firefox. If you can convince those companies to integrate Bitcoin into the browser, there will be an explosion in usage. And the good news is that one of those companies is actually very, very interested in integrating it.
And I guess we can guess which company that is now. And I don't want to take anything away from CryptoKit, which is a Google Chrome plugin that does Bitcoin, but if we could have Bitcoin built right in to Chrome and Safari and Firefox and Internet Explorer, that would be a tremendous boost indeed for Bitcoin. Now, before I go on, can I just stop for a second and say it is really cold here in Northern Virginia. I'm looking at my little handy-dandy computer thermometer. It's 10 degrees outside and it's noon. What is wrong with this world? I would have gone to that Miami Bitcoin conference, North American Bitcoin conference in Miami, and stayed for a couple extra weeks. One of the featured speakers there was Wunderkind Vitalik Buterin, who's now started a company called Ethereum. And there's a great article in Wired magazine entitled "Out in the Open: Teenage Hacker Transforms Web into One Giant Bitcoin Network." Article by Clint Finley. says that Buterick envisions Ethereum as an online service that lets you build practically anything in the image of Bitcoin and runs it across a worldwide network of machines. Ethereum is a completely new system, though, that will run across atop its own network, but it does borrow heavily from the ideas behind Bitcoin. Buterin says it will be particularly well-suited to something called smart contracts. A simple example is a betting system. Two people could place bets on, say, the outcome of the Super Bowl, entrusting a certain amount of digital currency to the system. The system would then check the final score of the game via the web and distribute the funds appropriately. No bookie needed. But he envisions far more complex smart contracts, including joint savings accounts, financial exchange markets, or even trust funds. Theoretically, these contracts would be more trustworthy because if the software is properly designed, no one could cheat. Many Bitcoin geeks even believe that smart contracts could even lead to the creation of autonomous corporations, entire companies run by bots instead of humans. The article continues to say that the Ethereum team plans to have a test network up and running soon, and on February 1, will launch a crowdfunding campaign to finance its further development. The code will be open source, another reflection of the Bitcoin way. So the team is going to launch a test network before rolling out the real thing. Buterin says it won't be the official network and transactions won't carry over, but it will likely be quite buggy and fail a lot at first. So in other words, it's very early days for this new age software system, but Ethereum and other next generation crypto platforms paint a very attractive picture of our online future, one where users are in control, not governments or big companies. Building this future is an enormous task, but Vitalik Buterin wouldn't have it any other way. Also in the news, TigerDirect.com, the computer hardware seller online, announced that they will accept Bitcoin, and apparently they've received about $500,000 of orders in Bitcoin already. Well, that makes two kind of major retailers so far in 2014 that have announced they'll accept Bitcoin, Overstock and Tiger Direct. Who else will we see in the coming year? Mark your calendars for March 1st, Millibit Conversion Day. Someone out on Reddit proposed that we make March 1st the day that we convert everything into millibits instead of talking about Bitcoin as the unit. You know, one of the difficulties we have with switching back and forth between Bitcoin and millibit is that you may see a price for something expressed in millibit. Let's say it's 50 millibit. Well, you go paste 50 into your Bitcoin wallet and press send, and you forgot to change it over to millibits. It's left in Bitcoin. Now you've just sent 1,000 times more than what you intended to the recipient. So if we convert everything to millibit, we will reduce that problem. Well, let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of Bitcoin gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their Bitcoin philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Men Machine Episode 5 is Bruce Schneier. Bruce Schneier, born January 15th, 1963, now that's a year and a half after Barack Obama, is an American cryptographer, computer security and privacy specialist, and writer. He's the author of several books on general security topics, computer security and cryptography, and a book that I have in my hands, the second edition of Applied Cryptography. Came out in about 1996, I'm looking. Oh, let's look at the copyright page. Yep, 1996. Now, he's very knowledgeable about cryptography. He's actually been involved in the creation of many cryptographic algorithms, such as Twofish, Blowfish, Threefish, MacGuffin. Yeah, those are actually names of block ciphers. Even pseudo-random number generators, stream ciphers, hash functions. He's a board member of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and his blog is found at schneier.com. Now, you can do a search through his blog. I did a search on the word Bitcoin. Surprisingly, in fact, shockingly, very little is written about Bitcoin by Mr. Schneier. Now let me turn into the pages of his book, He's got a chapter, chapter 6, subsection 4 is on digital cash. He says cash is a problem. It's annoying to carry, it spreads germs, and people can steal it from you. Checks and credit cards have reduced the amount of physical cash flowing through society, but the complete elimination of cash is virtually impossible. It'll never happen. Drug dealers and politicians would never stand for it. Checks and credit cards have an audit trail. You can't hide to whom you gave money. On the other hand, checks and credit cards allow people to invade your privacy to a degree never before imagined. You might never stand for the police following you your entire life, but the police can watch your financial transactions. They can see where you buy gas, where you buy food, who you call on the telephone, all without leaving their computer terminals. People need a way to protect their anonymity in order to protect their privacy. He goes on to say in his book, happily, there is a complicated protocol that allows for authenticated but untraceable messages. And then he goes on to describe digital cash. He says, lobbyist Alice can transfer digital cash to Congress critter Bob so that newspaper reporter Eve does not know about Alice's identity. Bob then can deposit that electronic money into his bank account even though the bank has no idea who Alice is. He continues later, a great social need exists for this kind of thing. With the growing use of internet for commercial transactions, there is more call for network-based privacy and anonymity in business. And in brackets, he says, there are good reasons people are reluctant to send their credit card numbers over the internet. On the other hand, though, banks and governments seem unwilling to give up the control that the current banking system's audit trail provides. They'll have to, though. All it will take for digital cash to catch on is for some trustworthy institution to be willing to convert the digits to real money. Digital cash protocols are very complex. And then he goes on to build up several protocols trying to make digital cash work. And I'm skipping ahead a few pages here. And then on page 146, he says, in a paper called Universal Electronic Cash, written in Advances in Cryptology, the Crypto 91 Proceedings, Tatsuaki Akamoto and Kazuo Ota list 6 properties of an ideal digital cash system. Now get this name again. Tatsuaki Akamoto. Does that sound like any name that you've heard before? Well, the ideal properties of a digital cash system are independence, one. The security of the digital cash is not dependent on any physical location. The cash can be transferred through computer networks, Bitcoin. Two, security. The digital cash cannot be copied and reused, Bitcoin. Three, privacy, untraceability. The privacy of the user is protected. No one can trace the relationship between the user and his purchases. Partly, Bitcoin. Four, offline payment. When a user pays for a purchase with electronic cash, the protocol between the user and the merchant is executed offline. That is, the shop does not need to be linked to a host to process the user's payment. Not really working in Bitcoin at this point. Five, transferability. The digital cash can be transferred to other users, Bitcoin. And six, the last one, divisibility. A piece of digital cash can be given in an amount that can be subdivided into smaller pieces, blah, 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 of course, Bitcoin. So Tatsuaki Akamoto is referenced by Bruce Schneier in his Applied Cryptography book. And he has a whole subsection here on digital cash, but on his website, he doesn't really talk very much at all about Bitcoin. You know, he's very good at privacy, very good at privacy. He's very good at keeping secrets. He knows how to keep secrets. I think one of the biggest secrets Bruce Schneier is keeping is that he is Satoshi Nakamoto. Well, congratulations, Bruce Schneier. You're the guru on Madman Machine Episode 5. Now, I'm not really seriously saying that I think Bruce Schneier is Satoshi Nakamoto, although he's never really denied being Satoshi. You know, he's a real enigma when it comes to Bitcoin. And he did write about Tatsuaki Akamoto in his digital cash section of his book. Well, let's take a minute to look at the market. I'm switching over to Bitstamp for prices. I think Mt. Gox is a little bit shaky these days. And we're going to use blockchain.info for our info. Current price of Bitcoin is about 80 cents per millibit. Total number of Bitcoins in circulation, 12.28 million. Market cap at that price, $9.83 billion. Average time between blocks, 8.94 minutes. The reward per block, right at $20,000. And transaction fees per block, $67.58, down about 4% from last week. The prices in last week's trading ranged from a high of 83 cents down to a low of 72 cents at Bitstamp.com. Transactions per day, 62,000, down about 4% from last week. And the average number of transactions per block, 388, up 20% from last week. That's your Mad Money Machine Market Minute. Well, we had two really interesting shows about Bitcoin come out within the past week or so, both of them involving Andreas Antonopoulos. The first one was Andreas interviewing Adam Back, noted cryptologist, inventor of Hashcash. Now, can you imagine Andreas interviewing somebody? You know it's got to be good if he's asking the questions. Very technical interview, couple hours long. I took detailed notes. Then the other interview was of Andreas Antonopoulos on the Joe Rogan Show. 3 hours long, that one. That's much more aimed at the beginner. What is Bitcoin all about and how does it change the world? I recommend you give them both a good listen. But the thing that really fascinated me about the interview with Adam Back was his idea that we should not put a whole lot of focus on altcoins. We should keep all the focus, all the mind share on Bitcoin. And, you know, we recognize that some of the great things about an altcoin is it's a laboratory for experimentation. But he says that there could be a way to develop a Bitcoin dev project that operates in parallel of the existing, the production Bitcoin, if you will. The Bitcoin development track could be the test bed for new features. And he says this development track of Bitcoin could not be mining Bitcoins. Instead, Bitcoins would move from the production Bitcoin track into the development Bitcoin track. They would just move there in one direction, one for one. But in order to move them back, though, you have to pay at market rate. So that's the concepts that I was really interested in. One, don't put any focus on altcoins. Put all the focus on Bitcoin itself. But for experimentation, keep that dev track. Now, I don't think anyone is seriously talking about using this type of system yet. So what are the plans for Bitcoin 0.9? And what are the plans for Bitcoin in the future? I've got some of that information for you right here.
My name is Mike Kern, and I'm a Bitcoin developer. I've done a lot of work on core developments, and I've been involved with Bitcoin I've used it since 2009, and I've been developing it since 2010. So I want to give you a bit of a look ahead, brief look ahead at stuff that's going on in the development world, upcoming features, and then I'll talk about some other stuff. So I've worked a bit on the Satoshi client, but actually mostly I work on this library called Bitcoin J, which underlies the Android Bitcoin wallet app by Andreas Schildbeck, and also Multibit, and an upcoming Mac wallet called Hive. And then there are a couple of other wallet apps that use it as well. And it's also used in blockchain.info and a bunch of other apps. Satoshi Dice used a bit of this code as well, a whole bunch of things. So these are what we call, these are sort of like lightweight peer-to-peer wallets, right? So when you use these apps, you're talking to the peer-to-peer network. And when you use something like blockchain.info or Electrum, you're not. That's kind of the key difference. So one of the things we're doing is we're working on these HD wallets. That's not high-resolution wallets. That's hierarchical deterministic wallets. One problem we've got at the moment is like wallets are not really compatible with each other. I mean, they all talk on the Bitcoin network, but if you have a wallet and you want to import it into another app, then you know maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. HD wallets is a project to standardize wallet formats and allow you to just write down 12 words on a bit of paper. And then you can restore into any wallet app. So you see some of these things happening at the moment with paper wallets, and like Electrum has pioneered some of this stuff. What we're doing is we're standardizing it, making these techniques better so everything will use it. And this is really important for the Trezor hardware wallet, which is coming up. It's gonna start shipping this month, actually. And then we need to get everyone onto these hardware wallets because otherwise you're all gonna get your money stolen, basically. what else are we working on? So, Bitcoin addresses. I love them, they're nice and simple. We need to scrap them, right? Because They are too limited and they cause all kinds of problems. So starting at the end of 2012, myself and Gavin brainstormed a lot, and we did a lot of design work on something called the payment protocol, which is a really dumb name because don't we pay with Bitcoin protocol? Well, yeah, but we don't have a better name for it. The payment protocol basically replaces addresses with small files that contain payment instructions. And because these are little files, we can add data to them and add features over time. And this is going to be really important for lots and lots of features that we need to implement over the coming years. Version one of the payment protocol, which is just the start, when you pay with it, you can submit a refund address to the merchants so they can refund you reliably. Today, that sort of doesn't, you know, people try and do refunds with Bitcoin, it doesn't really work. Memos, so you can get a message from the merchant and you can send a message back when you pay. Currently, you can't attach messages to Bitcoin transactions, that's going to be fixed. Receipt. If you buy something with Bitcoin today, you have no way to prove that you made a purchase. And this means if there's any kind of dispute, you just have to trust that it's going to work out okay. All the information in payment protocol can be signed under some kind of verified identity. If you want, it's optional. And so this means you can get proof of purchase, and this is useful for bootstrapping dispute mediated transactions and all kinds of other things, and loads of stuff. Yeah, so like dispute mediation, maybe in future social network integration, privacy upgrades as well, basically loads of good stuff. Fees. You probably noticed that in the last 8 months, Bitcoin became about 80 times more expensive to use than it used to be. This is because there's a minimum fee requirement on transactions, which is hard-coded, and it's set in terms of Bitcoin. So when the value versus the dollar went up by 80-fold, so did the fee. This makes no sense, because it didn't actually become 80 times more expensive to process a transaction. So at the moment, Gavin is working on this pretty heavily, and I've been doing a bit of work on this as well. We're going to make the minimum fee float. So the idea here is that hopefully we can really start forcing fees down this year, and this is going to be important once we start making the scalability upgrades needed to go beyond 7 transactions a second, which, as Jeremy pointed out, is not much. Visa actually handles 10,000 transactions per second at peak, and that's just Visa. Right? MasterCard is another 8,000-9,000 transactions per second on top. Also, you know, fees, currently the sender pays the fee, even though it's the receiver that cares about the confirmation. This makes no sense. We need the payment protocol to fix that as well, a bunch of other stuff. Something I've been looking at in the last few weeks, actually, is for these peer-to-peer wallet apps like the Shieldback Wallet and Multibit, can we route all traffic through Tor by default?
And here, Mike Hearn went on to talk about some of the vulnerabilities in using the wallets in a peer-to-peer fashion and how Tor could help that. Now, coincidentally, on episode 32 of Let's Talk Bitcoin, Adam interviewed Jeffrey Paul, a.k.a. Sneak, and he was talking about Tor and how Tor is not really completely anonymous if you look at it from a traffic analysis perspective. So what Tor needs is a whole lot more nodes running on the network and all running sort of the same size data packets across it to really make things mixed up and anonymous. Well, embedding Bitcoin by default in Bitcoin wallets could sure help that. Now, at the end of Mike Hearn's talk, he got into something a lot more detailed and technical about how using passports with chips in them can be used in a system where you prove that a program run correctly, and that helps in some way to indicate that your nodes are operating correctly and you're an authentic node on the Tor network. Too technical for me. You can Google Mike Hearn's talk in London at a meetup there if you want to really get into the details of that. Perhaps a little bit closer to the future are the features that will be released in Bitcoin version 0.9, an article out at the Genesis Block about the significant merchant improvements planned for Bitcoin. Include the ability to significantly increase merchant and customer usability in 4 key areas: ease of payment, recurring payments, dispute resolution, and immediate feedback transactions. The key improvement here is the new type of payment messages where a merchant can send a signed request, a payment request, specifying the amount to be paid and a description of the transaction. The customer can then send payment to the merchant and receive an acknowledgement of the transaction with a message from the merchant. Don't have the release date for Bitcoin 0.9. I hope they get it right, and I hope they release it soon. Forget about Mike Hearn, though. Let's hear from a real expert that I heard on Yahoo Finance.
Brian, for sure, every time a new vendor comes on, that's positive for Bitcoin. But the reality is this is just a total mania. There is absolutely nothing behind this. And it's just like the tulip bulb mania in Holland in the past and other, the gold mania recently. This is a bubble and it's going to burst and the ultimate direction is down.
Oh, well, I guess that's it then for the Mad Money Machine. Sorry to waste your time. I guess I won't be doing any more shows on this stupid currency that's not going anywhere but down. Well, we'll just see, dude, who's right in the end, won't we? In the meantime, yes, I will see you next Thursday. This is Paul Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes Bitcoin to make a Mad Money Machine. Between now and then, buy some Bitcoin, spend some Bitcoin, donate some Bitcoin, and then replenish your Bitcoin. My donation address is Meet Happiness Eager Like Hill Beam. Abuse confidence, goodbye. Awake, scary dude, Diamond Flicker Law. Go to madmoneymachine.com to find other ways to donate to the show if you like it. Email me, Bitcoin at Mad Money Machine. On Twitter, find me, Mad Money Machine, and Facebook, Mad Money Machine, as well as Reddit. Thank you so much for listening. I've enjoyed it. I hope you have too.